On this week's show, we talk about some of the flawed data underlying some of Texas's shelter-in-place orders. We'll also find out what Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager is telling us about our economic outlook. We're joined by Texas Railroad Commissioner Ryan Sitton, who tackles falling oil prices and what Texas might be able to do about that problem. And finally, is it right to call it the Chinese coronavirus? Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan has some thoughts on that in this week's commentary. Welcome to another week of Texas Scorecard Radio. I, of course, am your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Central Texas. As always, you can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. Lots of writers, lots of articles going up there. If you're not already subscribed to the program, we go out not only on the website and as a radio show to radio stations, to you terrestrial radio listeners. This is also distributed as a podcast, so you can make sure you never miss an episode of Texas Scorecard Radio by going on and subscribing on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify. If it's a podcasting platform, we're probably on there. You can probably find us. With that out of the way, wanted to get started with this week's news. Obviously, the biggest news of the week, it continues to be all of the actions being taken, not only from the federal government, but by state and local governments dealing with the coronavirus challenge. You have these orders coming down from many local governments, urban governments in the state of Texas, shelter-in-place orders telling folks essentially to stay in their homes unless they have kind of an exception where they can leave their homes to come and work or do different things. And on the line, I've got Robert Montoya up in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. You were looking in, Robert, at this Dallas order and some of the statements that Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins has made about the order and the studies that they're citing. You're going, hey, wait a second. Some of the things that they're basing these decisions on are not very sound.
Yes, that's right, Tony. So, as you said, a lot of counties and local governments are now instituting what's called shelter-in-place orders, limiting a lot of business activity and requiring people to stay home except for essential needs. And Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins, in his decision, which, by the way, he did not discuss or get consent from the other commissioners of Dallas County when he did this, put the order in place, he touted data from a model called COVID Act Now, which is based on a study from the Imperial College of London. And this study says that if Texas doesn't do shelter in place, we'll probably experience about 430,000 Texans dying.
Yeah, which is, I mean, obviously we're a far cry from that. We hope that isn't the case. That's a, you know, I don't know, apocalyptic might be a little too extreme of a word, but it's seriously a very concerning number to throw out there. But you started looking into the study, and there's a ton of qualifications in this study where they say, well, this is, you know, this is what we're concluding, that it's going to be millions and millions and millions of people are going to die. But here are some of the assumptions, and the assumptions are like, whoa, that's a really big deal.
Yeah, so, you know, as you said, this model comes with a lot of asterisks, which they're calling known limitations. And I'll just read a few here. One of them they say is only a small fraction of the world has been affected. It's a new disease. Variables will change. The factor they use where they outline how fast the disease spreads each period, they says, you know, these are guesses, in some cases informed by data. And also they say that, you know, demographics, populations, hospital bed counts are outdated. Demographics for the USA as a whole are used rather than specific to each state. So, you know, these are, and they say this, there's even more, and they say the list is non-exhaustive, which means there's even more qualifiers around this thing. And the fact an elected official would base a decision on this really calls into question.
Yeah, so basically County Judge Jenkins is out there saying, hey, I need to issue this order, this rather extreme order, telling folks to essentially stay in their homes, because if I don't do it, you know, 500,000 Texans are going to die. And the study, you go to read the study and you go, wait a second, these folks really don't know. You know, like most of us, like all of us, they have very limited information, and they know that, you know, obviously there's a disease that's on the march and there are risks and people are certainly being affected. affected very negatively by it. But, you know, whether it's something that we've never seen before where you're going to have these extreme reactions, the study really just doesn't back that up. And I think I've seen that there are some other competing studies, Oxford University out with something that says, no, this is something much more akin to what we've experienced with the seasonal flu.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because now we are, like you're saying, we're also hearing rumblings from other members of the medical community calling the question just this, like, how we're reacting to all this. And something else that's really important to note, also in the exceptions that the study has, it says that they assume everyone spreads the disease at the same rate. In practice, there are some folks who are super spreaders and others who are almost isolated. So they're even, you know, that's just an even more point that this is not something you should government be basing their decision off of. And we know this study has been going around the world, and, you know, it's even made the rounds in Harris County, whether or not Harris based their decision on this. You know, this is just a really questionable study. And if you go to the website, they even say that their purpose is to promote shelter-in-place orders.
Yeah, so this is what they're doing. Yeah, well, I'd encourage listeners, go check out Robert's post up at TexasScorecard.com. Obviously, you know, this is a serious situation that has to be confronted seriously, but there's so much alarmism that's laced through it. And so I think that's very helpful to point that out. Appreciate your reporting, Robert.
Thank you, Tony.
Next, let's turn to Carrie Cheshire, Vice President with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Carrie, you've been covering developments with Comptroller Glenn Hager relative to this current economic downturn. Tell us what he's saying.
That's right, Tony. So Glenn Hager's kind of saying two things. Number one, he's telling state lawmakers and then actually the general public earlier this week that we need to prepare for a budgetary shortfall, that the state of Texas is not going to pull in as much tax revenue as originally anticipated. And he's also telling businesses, for the most part, hey, we're not going to issue a blanket waiver allowing you to delay remitting your sales taxes. So right now in March, the sales taxes for the month of February are coming due. They were actually due last Friday. And typically after a natural disaster or something, the comptroller does allow small businesses especially to delay those payments, allowing them to keep that cash flow for a little while to hopefully kind of recover a little bit while they're waiting on insurance payments and other things like that. The comptroller signaling after this disaster that he will be working case by case with businesses, but there will be no blanket waiver.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a program in place where folks can apply and say, okay, you know, I can't pay the money in now. How can I get on a payment plan? And there might be some waivers of interest and penalties that would normally apply in a situation like that, but no blanket waiver. And I think this is really kind of eye-opening about the financial situation of Texas government, but maybe government generally. The suggestion is they just really couldn't do that.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. So obviously, like, Glenn Hager is taking a lot of flack from small businesses and folks. You see a lot of people lighting him up on Twitter. He would not do this if it weren't necessary, which is what has led a lot of people to believe that maybe the state of Texas has a cash flow problem going into this recession. Obviously, lawmakers spent too much during the budgetary session. But then again, even if they didn't spend too much, 58% of their revenue collections is sales tax collection. It'd be tough for any money out, money in organization to go a month forbearing that.
Yeah, and so in the same sense that, you know, businesses are having trouble, well, the government might be on the verge of having some trouble as well if they don't take that tax in. Turning back to the budgetary issues, I mean, what are we looking at? We're looking at a pretty significant shortfall coming into the next session, which is going to mean, you know, major cuts.
Well, that's right, Tony. I mean, you had Hager giving a very rosy projection at the beginning of the legislative session, then coming up with an even rosier extra $500 million in projected revenue to help lawmakers make ends meet with all of their spending boondoggles. You're seeing that actual collections have really lagged behind that. For what it's worth, the comptroller was projecting the price of oil in the mid-50s. As most folks know, it's down in the 20s right now, which does a big, big number on the budget. So they're looking at a probably sizable, in the terms of billions of dollars, deficit that might have to be addressed in a special session sometime this summer. The comptroller did say that he would issue a new revenue projection this summer. If they're having immediate cash flow problems, they would need to come back and do it then. What we're doing at Texans for Fiscal Responsibility is finding and identifying several cuts that the legislature and Governor Greg Abbott could make right now to hopefully stave off some of that coming economic hardship for the state and for taxpayers.
Yeah, well, folks, check those out. TexasScorecard.com, lots of good suggestions about ways we can be tightening our belt.
That's right. Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At TexasScorecard.com or EmpowerTexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at EmpowerTexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, as we're facing the challenges of the coronavirus and the economic shutdown that comes with it, many Texans know that our economy really exists on oil and gas and oil and gas production, and they look at the price of oil and go, ooh, that's another area of concern. And so to talk about that and some of the things that the state can and will be doing, I'm joined this week with by Commissioner, Railroad Commissioner Ryan Sitton. Thank you for joining us.
Tony, it's good to be here with you. Thank you.
Yeah, so you're one of the three commissioners on the Railroad Commission and have a responsibility for regulating the Texas oil and gas industry. And I want you to just kind of, if we could start, kind of lay out the challenge that we're facing right here in the oil and gas industry. There's this, you have a couple of problems, a huge increase in supply because of some foreign actors, and then a serious demand challenge. Because, look, airplanes aren't flying, cars aren't driving, all of that. Tell us a little bit about what the challenge is that we're facing, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit about the role that the commission might be playing in that in the coming weeks.
Sure, Tony. Well, you just laid out the challenge. The challenge is we've got two things happening on both the supply and the demand side of this market. On the supply side, the Russians and the Saudis are in a global match to see who's got the bigger stroke in terms of oil market. The Saudis have put an additional 2 million barrels a day of production on the market, and the Russians aren't cutting. And so as a consequence, the global production of oil went up by somewhere between 2 and 3 million barrels a day from 2 months ago. In the same time period, coronavirus has hit the world. You're having people aren't driving to work. They're not driving the kids to school. Just basic infrastructure is shutting down. You've got people aren't flying in planes. And so as a result, right now our speculation is the demand for oil and gas has dropped between 10 and 15 million barrels a day. So to put this into context, the world went from slightly oversupplied about a month or a month and a half ago, maybe a million barrels a day oversupplied in a 100 million barrel a day market, to now being oversupplied somewhere between 15 and 20%.
Yeah, so
let's slow down on those numbers.
Yeah, can we slow down? So it's the worldwide market, and I just learned this the other day, so it's 100 million barrels of oil a day that's being produced and then consumed. And yes, you've had a little bit of supply bump on this whole Russian-Saudi thing, but the bigger issue to me sounds like this major, and it's probably a short-term issue, but this major short-term reduction in demand.
You're exactly right, Tony. Yeah, so 100 million barrels a day, and right now that's where it was, and it was roughly that much was being produced and consumed. Now we're producing around the world 103 million barrels a day, and we're only probably using 85. And to put that into context real quick, that is the biggest oversupply or the biggest disparity in history. We've never seen it on a percentage or absolute barrel basis that big for any sustained period of time. Now, you just said, well, Ryan, it seems like the demand side is really the bigger issue and that it may be short term. Yes and yes, there's a maybe on that short term, depending on, you know, what happens with governments. I mean, if we keep these countries, and just take the United States, if we keep our country shut down for another 2 months, we may go into a sustained depression that could last a long time. But let's hope that we begin to work our way out of this pretty quickly, and that demand side comes back in the next month or so.
And from a logistics standpoint of oil and gas, I think this is something that most folks don't understand. There's not, there are holding tanks and there are the strategic oil reserve and these different things where you could store some oil, but there's nothing out there to where you can dump 15 million barrels of oil to just say, oh, well, we'll just save it up for a rainy day.
Actually, you know what, Tony? Let me correct you on that a little bit. You're right, but let me put it in context. Actually, there is a ton of storage in the world. Literally, over 1 billion barrels of oil storage exists in the world today. However, it's almost full.
Mm.
That's where you're right. So in other words, if you said, hey, if all the storage was empty, dude, we could be storing up oil for a long time, no problem. But we'd been overproducing for a while, and storage was already pretty full. And at the rate that we're overproducing today, some estimates are that we're going to fill up our storage by June, which starts to get into some of the issues that the Railroad Commission of the State of Texas are going to run into. Because when you get to, hey, there's nowhere to store this oil, now we start getting into waste, we start getting into correlative rights, we start into real economic destruction.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, the role that the Railroad Commission is meant to play. And of course, we have this unique thing here in Texas. Railroad Commission used to regulate railroads, now only regulates, oil and gas and a few other things, but not railroads. What is the role with regard to oil and gas for the Railroad Commission?
Well, for those who don't know, we are the regulator for oil and gas, as you were alluding to. If you want to drill a well in Texas, you want to build a pipeline in Texas, you want to operate those assets, you have to come to us to get a permit, and you have to follow our rules. If there's ever a contested issue, someone says, I want to put in this disposal well. Someone else says, no, you shouldn't be able to do it there or that way. Who's the court where you go hear that case? That's also the Railroad Commission. We have an administrative court process to hear those cases and rule on them. So anything oil and gas related that's inside the state of Texas, we handle it. Now, when it comes to this issue, we have a specific power that we haven't used in a long, long time. In 1919, literally 100 years ago, the legislature granted the Railroad Commission the capability to set proration levels, which meant the Railroad Commission could tell operators around the state what percent of their maximum production they could actually release. Now, in 1973, in response to the first Middle East oil embargo, we raised those proration levels to 100%, and they've been there ever since. And if you ask a free market guy like me, I say, that's great. You know what? The oil and gas market is the most globally fungible market on the planet. When the market is free or relatively free, Americans tend to win. Our innovation, our entrepreneurship, we tend to develop things faster. We tend to win. However, that ability to set proration is there to ensure that in cases where, man, something goes really out of whack in the market, we can do things to prevent waste and ensure that not just the big kind of global oil companies are able to survive, but that everyone gets a fair shake.
Yeah, so let's break this down a little bit. I mean, obviously, if storage hits its max, if the price of oil is low because demand is just way under supply, I mean, I've heard people talking about, basically oil and gas producers having to pay to get rid of the stuff, pay to actually store it somewhere, or paying people to take it. And that seems incredibly wasteful to just be, essentially, in a sense, not physically, but you're basically dumping our, oil and gas and our precious, this commodity that's so important to the state, just essentially dumping it out on the ground is the way it might as well be what's happening. Is that really something that could happen if the commission doesn't step up to try to intervene?
I doubt we get to the point people are dumping it on the ground, but I know
you're not physically dumping it on the ground. But
yeah, I know you're saying that figuratively, but just to clarify, but to your point, the almost equivalent could occur where, hey, this stuff is so worthless, I'm going to shut in and abandon wells because I don't have any economic infrastructure to continue to support this. And so it's not just about the barrel today that's about to come out of a well. It's about the fact that we'll need those barrels in 2 months when the market comes back. But if in the meantime we've had to shut them all in, some of these wells, when you shut them in, there is some technical reports that those wells will be damaged and they won't be able to produce as much over the long haul. You'll also see portions of the market where infrastructure will be completely shut down. So therefore, even if that well could produce, there's no infrastructure to get it to market, which means now a whole section, a whole lease, a whole area is unproducible. So the end effect is the same as dumping it on the ground, which is if this happens, a whole bunch of oil is no longer going to be able to be produced. We just don't know how much.
Yeah, and so you basically have a massive destruction of wealth and then a destruction of companies that can't, as you were saying, ride out the storm. So maybe a larger company might be able to ride it out better than a smaller company, but you'd see these companies just have to abandon assets, abandon wells, abandon leases. I mean, economic destruction from all of that. And then, the cost of then trying to go in and rearrange those leases, just do all that over again. It seems massively expensive and incredibly wasteful.
It is. And look, let's not mince words here. In 1911, when the legislature broke up Standard Oil, when the federal government broke up Standard Oil, the reason was they said, look, Standard Oil has too much buying power. They can singularly affect the market because they control, they control transportation, i.e. the railroads, they control the steel, they control the pipelines. And so the issue was we need to ensure that there's an opportunity for small producers to also participate in this market to create competition. Well, when you see a significant demand drop like this, which is, I think we all can concede, that's not a market thing. This is an abnormal market scenario. What happens is the massive companies who have enough buying power to control storage and control inventory, control transportation, basically have the ability or will in effect put all the small producers out of business. And the question is that good for the consumer when you get back to 3-4 months away, because now there's very little free market left because this really weird scenario wiped out a lot of the competition and left only a few people standing. So it gets even into correlative rights if you can extrapolate. Yeah, it's not correlative rights on a lease basis, but on access to infrastructure and ability to get my oil to market if I'm a small producer as opposed to a mega producer.
Yeah, and quickly, for those who don't know what correlative rights is, it's basically the rights of various interests to oil and gas to have their proportionate share of it be protected. And basically, if you think back to that movie, you can't drink up your neighbor's milkshake,
that sort of thing. There you go. That's right.
Yeah. So so this is the proposal that's being floated, is that the Railroad Commission, for the first time in, I guess, almost 50 years, would start looking at proration and would implement that. How does that process go? Is that something that the Railroad Commission would just, you would meet and have an order, and then how would it work?
Well, how it would work is like what you said. The Railroad Commission, we have regular conferences, regular meetings. We put it on an agenda, and the first step is to hear testimony. In fact, let's make sure everyone really understands. There is no proposal to begin prorating today. What I am proposing, and I think Chairman Christian has put out a statement saying something similar, is, look, we want to hear all the ideas. At this point, we're in extraordinary circumstances. We need to be willing to look at any solution to help ensure that Texas and Texas industries last through this massive downturn. And so I want to hear what people have to say on this. Is it something that's a good idea, a bad idea? If it is a good idea, what are ideas on how we would implement it? What are the mechanics? We did this the last time 50 years ago. What lessons would we learn from the last 50 years to make this more effective and ensure that whatever we do from a government perspective, we undo very quickly? How do we make sure this doesn't become something that has, some sort of long-term effect? Because we don't want the government regulating the markets as some sort of long-term thing. But the biggest issue, Tony, is how do we use this as Texans to lead and to get the Saudis and the Russians and everybody internationally to also start looking at being practical in this market environment, right? Because it's not good for anybody globally to destroy affordable, reliable energy. You look at the poorest countries in the world, they need affordable, reliable energy more than we do just to sustain life. So at this time, from a very humane perspective, what are we doing to ensure that's going to be accessible and not let this massive downturn, you know, make us suffer through unstable high energy prices for a long time?
Yeah, well, I think we're really blessed that there's been an oil and gas revolution here in the state. We've always been a leader in oil and gas, but you know, if this were 20, 30 years ago, it would have been a little bit of a different picture. But Texas is such a major producer of oil and gas today that we can have some outsized say on the way things go internationally. And so I think it's a really important thing to be addressing. I appreciate you coming on and joining us for this, and we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you for the work you're doing to try and preserve Texas's most important industry.
I appreciate it, Tony. Thanks for giving me the time today.
What's in a name? Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan addresses the Chinese coronavirus in this week's commentary.
There are any number of ways to address someone. Their full name, a nickname, their honorific title and last name. An inmate might be known by their correctional institution's number. Whataburger knows me by the table tip number assigned to my order. Speaking of which, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary. Think about what I just said. I introduce myself the way I always do professionally, by all three of my names, because my first and last name are so incredibly common. Quinn is my middle name. Now, some folks, thinking perhaps my last name is hyphenated, will address me as Mr. Quinn. I'm not sure why Sullivan gets left off and all that. Now, it usually takes me a second or two to realize that I'm being addressed, but I'll respond to Mr. Quinn. If someone really wanted to ensure accuracy in addressing me, I suppose that could be accomplished by addressing me by either my passport, driver's license, or social security number, all randomly assigned by government computers and conventions and completely unique. It would be very scientific. But such a scheme isn't convenient. It sounds robotic. So we stick with the common names our moms and dads so lovingly picked out for us. All of which makes the outrage du jour so funny. The politically correct outrage machine is furious with the name Chinese coronavirus. The subculture of Americans who stand at ready 24/7 to be offended at everything are demanding we call the current pandemic by its unscientifically scientific name, COVID-19. Why is it even COVID-19, one might ask? Well, coronavirus disease of 2019, according to the World Health Organization. The CO comes from corona, the VI from virus, and D from disease. This, frankly, is stupid. Should everyone born in 2019 express horror at sharing that shame? Or maybe it's everyone who's 19, or everyone who had a corona with their hamburger. Everyone needs to calm down. In fact, the virus is actually scientifically designated SARS-CoV-2. But the bureaucrats at WHO specifically don't want it called that publicly because, very specifically, the phrase SARS makes people scared. Well, so much for the whole dispassionate science naming thing. Naming epidemics after the location of the outbreak is well-grounded in history and practice. It speaks to the spread of the disease and gives a sense of its impact. There wasn't any outrage or recall over the MERS outbreak. That stands, of course, for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. And no, it didn't start in Kansas. Such is also the case with a number of other maladies we've heard of throughout the years. There's the Spanish flu, West Nile, Ebola, and Zika, all of which were named in relation to their geographic origin. Chinese correctly identifies the point of origin, and even more correctly identifies the fact that it has spread as widely as it has because the Chinese government chose to hide the virus's emergence and rapid spread. It's fairly evident why the brutal, murderous communist government of China is haranguing its media and bureaucratic puppets into manufactured outrage over a time-honored colloquial naming scheme as a way to protect its fragile PR image. Less evident is why some people insist on capitulating to them. Folks get to choose what they're outraged, inflamed, or insulted by. I refuse to expend energy in keeping track of what triggers the countless and constantly shifting sensitivities of a culture that has capitulated to the cult of victimhood. As such, I'll continue to refer to it as the Chinese coronavirus. This is Table Tent 92, I mean Michael Quinn Sullivan, with a Texas Scorecard radio commentary.
Well, folks, that's all I have for you this week. Thanks for listening, and stay safe out there.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.